Trustee Fleckenstein did me the honor of asking if I would introduce Jim Porter to all this afternoon, and I'm pleased to do so. Jim is a distinguished scholar in the field of rhetoric and composition, and I know we're in for a treat this afternoon. I'm going to talk very briefly about some of his work to give you a context for his remarks today, and then I'll speak a little bit about what I know about Jim as a person. And even so, he did that to me. So, he's a professor of English and affiliated, actually a permanent faculty member also, with the Armstrong Institute for Interactive Media Studies, which is an interdisciplinary site focusing on, as you might expect, interactive media studies. He's also the director of the American Culture and English Program at Miami University, which focuses on the needs of international students as they prepare to take up work in the English-American academic culture. He did his bachelor's degree at John Carroll University, his master's at the University of Michigan, and his PhD at the University of Detroit, working under Janice Lauer, who then went on to found the well-known rhetoric and comp program at Purdue University, where two of the faculty in this program actually completed their degrees. So if you're doing an academic genealogy, you have the start of something there. He served at several universities, among them Purdue, also at Michigan State, where he founded the WIDE Center, which stands for Writing in Digital Environments. It is a research center. What I learned this afternoon that I hadn't known before is that a lot of their funding came from assessment work. So for those of you who are interested in assessment, there are dollars to chase. And it was actually a well-funded center. It's a compliment to him that not only did he found the center, but also when he left the center, it continued to thrive. That's not the story for many centers. Often they disappear when their leader, especially their founder, departs. And in this case, it is a tribute to him that it continues to do good work. And what's also interesting is that it sponsors research in the field, as I'm sure you're aware. So that's no small achievement. He went to Miami University several years ago, where he actually began directing first-year comp. So he's held a variety of administrative positions. His research interests, as his webpage will tell you, include rhetoric with particular attention, though his webpage doesn't say it, to audience, to theory and ethics of research methodology, which is one of his current interests, and in digital rhetoric and online writing situations, which is also one of his current interests. Just to give you some sense of some of his publications, his first book was Audience and Rhetoric, an Archaeological Composition of the Discourse Community, published in 1992, so a little over 20 years ago. And I think that was the first, it was a very nice study of audience, really focused on audience, and did some very good work, and so it got a lot of favorable attention. Not too long after that, he published with Pat Sullivan at Purdue, Opening Spaces, Writing Technologies, and Critical Research Practices. And here I would make the observation that Jim, like many members of the field, has co-authored a good deal of his work, and Pat Sullivan has been one of his frequent writing partners. And he talked this morning, for those of you who were able to come, and those of you who weren't, about the partnership that he had with Pat, how he learned from her about empirical methodologies, and how their work together with Microsoft helped them understand the relationship between theory and practice. He published with Pat, and then with Stuart Blythe, Jeff Grable, and Libby Miles, with Institutional Critique, A Research Methodology for Change, which was published in College Composition and Communication, and which won the Braddock Award for Best Article in Theses, which is no small achievement, something to which many of us aspire, a few of us are chosen. He also published Why Technology Matters to Writing, A Cyber Writer's Tale in Computers and Composition, which is a very nicely nuanced account of his own writing practices and how he moved from the typewriter to the computer and what difference that made to his writing. So it's a signature piece that was, in fact, in a double issue in 2004 that was offered by a computer composition to celebrate their own 20th anniversary. So it's signature in a couple of ways. Then, under the moniker of the Wide Research Center Collective, so again, a lot of people involved there, but a kind of co-authorship that deletes the names, which is pretty interesting, published in Kairos, a question that some of us are still contending with: why teach digital writing? Not long after that, with his partner, Heidi McGee, he published a book, The Ethics of Internet Research, A Rhetorical Case-Based Process, which, as those of you this morning will attest, he referenced in terms of thinking about some of the situations that we raised with him. It's always very helpful. Then, of course, for those of you who are in the reading group, you're familiar with Recovering Delivery for Digital Rhetoric in Computers and Composition. It was also an award winner, winning the Ellen Nold Award for Best Article in the Field of Computers and Composition. And I might note that the Ellen Nold actually meant theory of composing. That's what she was known for. That's why it was named after her. So it is, those of you who are asking about composing process research, well, there it is, and that's a tribute to that. In 2010, he published Rhetoric as in a Digital Economy in the Stuart Selbert Collection, Rhetorics and Technologies. And with Heidi, he published The Ethics of Archaeological Research in Seas in the special issue that was focused on research. He's done several things in the interim, both before and after, and he promises today to help us understand about delivery in ways we haven't. What I was getting about Jim is that he's personally, so he's quite an accomplished scholar, I think I was established that. If not, see me afterwards. as a person, he's got a wonderful sense of humor. He's very, very smart, which I think you saw this morning in the Q&A. He's always willing to think through things with people, and he's very much committed to the many ways that we can ethically support students. That, again, is also something of a tribute. You did decide to join us, we're so glad. And will you please, now that you've joined us, join the rest of us in welcoming Jim Porter.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Appreciate your comments. I've got a handout for you. I'm going to be saying many strange things today, and I want you to know they're not all my fault. Some of them come from other people.
Oh, that's nice.
Thank you for inviting me here today. I've enjoyed getting to know Florida State and your program a little bit, and I've enjoyed meeting and talking with many of you about your work and about the program, and it's a great program. And I have been enjoying the weather, too. That's been very nice, coming from Ohio, where it's going to be 9 degrees tonight, I guess. So I'm staying tonight, so that's good. So I've got this little license, Creative Commons license, in the corner here on my title slide. But it's not only a license for the talk, but it's also an image that represents what I'm talking about, which is to say I'm going to be talking about access, circulation, and economics. And this license advises you, attempts to influence you, attempts to shape your circulation practices by telling you that you may share this, you may use this piece, the ideas in it, the words in it, the slides in it, any way you want, but you may not use this for commercial purposes, as if it might be remotely possible to do something. Good luck with that one. But that's really what I'm talking about, the things we do with our writing and to our writing to make it circulate, and the ways in which various systems block us. Let me rephrase that. The way that various systems both assist us in circulating and block us. And we're going to look at examples of both of those things. And the first part of this talk is going to be about delivery and about access, looking very much and mostly at the topoi of access. And what I'll do is present a bunch of historical stories, what I call delivery tales, that we'll come back to later in the talk. And maybe you'll decide that some of these are tales of rhetoric and some of them are not rhetoric, but that's one of the questions. What fits into rhetoric, what doesn't? The second part of the paper is about first the importance of seeing the role of system in delivery. How do systems, various kinds of systems, work? How do we shape various systems? How do we work within them to deliver and circulate? And how do they block and occlude our circulation of text? And secondly, and finally, I guess, the importance of having, protecting, securing a public commons for online writing. And this is my advocacy position. The most recent and immediate political issue here, of course, is net neutrality, a regulatory issue that might seem remote to the concerns of writing instructors and rhetoric scholars, but it's not. At its root, the issue involves a fundamental question about rhetoric. Who has the right to speak or write? And where and with what degree of circulatory freedom, how do we communicate our thoughts with others? And this issue has been going on in the public realm for quite some time, and I only see a small part of our field actually addressing this issue. And that's more or less the Intellectual Property Caucus, the people who are working on the intellectual property front who, and I've been in that caucus for since its beginning, 20 years now, and they are looking at the ways in which digital legislation is blocking and changing the ways that we write and produce and circulate online. And so that, to me, is a rhetoric concern. So I'm going to put these two or three parts together somehow to say that a focus on the commons and on the regulatory systems that construct and maintain the commons is part of the art of rhetoric. It falls under the canon of delivery. Why is that an important thing to do, to say that something is in the canon of delivery? I think it is important, but I'm not sure why. So maybe you can help me figure that out. That may be a category without a purpose, right? So we'll see. Let me first start out by situating my talk with a couple of extremes. Aristotle's view of delivery. It's not an elevated subject of inquiry. But still, the whole business of rhetoric being concerned with appearances, we have to pay attention to the subject of delivery, unworthy though it is. So delivery is like packaging on top of packaging, right? It's the worst possible canon to focus on. And then Demosthenes, when asked to name the three most important components of rhetoric, delivery, delivery, delivery. So I'm somewhere in between Aristotle and Demosthenes, but sliding more toward Demosthenes. I think it's pretty important, obviously. Two different frames here. The instrumental view of technology. The powers which shape men's lives may be expressed in books and type, but by itself, printing is only a tool, an instrument. And the multiplication of tools and instruments does not itself affect intellectual and spiritual life. Tools are simply media, pipelines that transmit message and communication. They don't change the message. They don't influence who we are. That's as opposed to one of my favorite books, Elizabeth Eisenstein's works. This is what I call a substantive view. The communication shift of the printing press altered the way Western Christians viewed their sacred book in the natural world. It made the words of God appear more multiform and his handiwork more uniform. The printing press laid the basis both for literal fundamentalism and for modern science. The tools enact huge cultural and social and intellectual change. So those are kind of two extreme positions, and the critical position, this is citing now Andrew Feinberg's work, Critical Theory of Technology, the critical position looks at both of those and says sometimes the tools matter, sometimes they don't, but I definitely slide more toward the substantive view. That's why I'm in computers and composition. It does have a huge effect on the way we think, the way we work. It's not just a neutral medium. The Western classical model of rhetoric, by which I mean the dominant framework that came from ancient Athens, Aristotle, went to Rome, Cicero, and Quintilian, assumes access. That is, it assumes that the speaker or rhetor has access to the public platform and has citizen rights to speak publicly, or will gain those rights through right of birth when they become a citizen after appropriate education. Most of this rhetoric is based on the premise, as Lyndall Buchanan says, that rhetors are male, privileged, and authorized to speak publicly, thus ignoring the concerns and constraints of those who are not. But it isn't just classical rhetoric, of course. This view has persisted in the Western academic rhetoric tradition. We can see it in the 18th century new rhetoric of Hugh Blair and George Campbell, the 1960s new rhetoric of Burke, Perelman, Tolman, and others. We see it in Strunk and White. We see it in The Everyday Writer. We see it in Everything's an Argument. We see it in Bazell and Hertzberg's The Rhetorical Tradition, first edition more so than second, but definitely the first edition. These rhetorical treatments assume that you already have access to the podium or will get it. The implied audience for these tracts is someone who has the required hall pass giving them the right to speak at the bar, the pulpit, and the assembly. Access is not a problem or a challenge to be taken up by rhetoric. And of course, this isn't everybody's rhetoric, and we start to see that in the rhetorical tradition edition too. It's not the case in the 17th century rhetorical world of Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz, who had to fight for the right to write as a woman in the Catholic Church. Or Sarah and Angelina Grimke's struggle in the 19th century for the right to speak publicly as women to a mixed audience of men and women. So for these rhetors, the key issue is establishing one's right to speak in the first place, including the right to be educated to speak at a certain level to engage the public podium. But there's a whole entire rhetoric tradition of subordinated and silenced tradition, traditions living under colonial rule, for instance, which have a different kind of struggle. For them, rhetoric isn't arrangement and style, it's being able to speak at all, having literacy access. And there's been a large number of groups who've been historically denied those rights, particularly women, marginalized ethnic and racial groups, and persecuted religious communities in the history of the Western tradition. James Friedel says that we need to expand our notion of rhetorical activity to include activities such as the mutilation of the Hermes episode during the Antonia Festival in Athens in 415-416 BCE. This was a protest by some anonymous persons, but most scholars think it was the women of Athens, protesting the Athenian males' warmongering tendencies against Sparta and Sicily. One night, unbeknownst to the male population, the Herm choppers cut, defaced, and vandalized the Herms in the city, the stone sculptures that were ubiquitous. They damaged and defaced the monumental inscriptions, the sculptures, the stone architecture. And that architecture, those inscriptions, were public writing in this time and place in classical Athens. Friedel says of the Hermocopidae, their act was powerful, prophetic, and heavily weighted with symbolic force. The Herm choppers marked out the dangers of phallic excess, of an overweening desire for pleasure and power. So this is certainly an example of rhetoric as embodied performance. Rhetoric is symbolic action. Rhetoric is protest. But it is also a story about access. How do people without access to public assembly gain the podium? How is their message heard? Well, here's how Martin Luther chose to deliver his message. He posted his 95 theses criticizing the Catholic Church on the church door at Wittenberg in 1517. He dramatically went to the church door, the story has it. He nailed the theses to the door, and nothing happened. This is how we romanticize the tale, but this is not really the story. Things didn't happen until he did that. He took his 95 theses, he printed them out, and he took them down the street to the print shop. And that's when action happened. And his protest in scribal form would not have had any effect, probably. It didn't, 100 years earlier in Europe, it would not have had any effect. But he had the technical means to get that message out, and between 1517 and 1520, his 30 publications sold well over 300,000 copies. So there's that dramatic revolution is made possible, and this is where you start to see the language sliding in the technological determinism, right? The technology made the Protestant Reformation happen. I don't go that far, but Elizabeth Eisenstein has a pretty strong statement, substantive statement in this direction. Especially when you look at this little data visualization. Cities with printing in 1450, one in Western Europe, Gutenberg's. 20 years later, and by 1500, that's where the printing presses are. And they're in urban areas, they're in seats of learning, university towns, they're on river towns. And so there's a circulatory system, which this map doesn't show you. If you put the rivers, overlay the rivers onto this map, you're going to see that this is a network of printing presses. And there's a circulation system going on here. On dark days, I think that what we do in composition is we're teaching students how to nailing their papers to the church door instead of teaching them that, That's what I worry about. But there's a countervailing force. So we've got the circulation going on in one direction, and the Catholic Church is, of course, totally dismayed that this is happening. And what do we do about it? We produce the Index of Forbidden Books, the Librorum Prohibitorum, which comes out. And on that list are most of the scientific works of the times, Luther's works and other works and so on. And here's a countervailing regulation that attempts to stop, occlude circulation of the works. It had some success in Spain and Italy, it has less success in France and Germany, so there's cultural attitudes going on in the system as well. But that's an attempt to control what the Catholic Church deems as heresy. And we see this all through the history of discourse, right, in various forms. The technologies enable a form of circulation, forms of circulation. So there are prohibitions, regulations, laws, which attempt to stop it, occlude it, prevent the copying in certain directions. The Statute of Anne is one such regulation in English Parliament. The U.S. Copyright Act of 1976 that was occasioned by the dramatic technology shift of the photocopier, which suddenly made it easier for copies to be made, though not distributed. And then the Internet really has turned things over, because not only can we make the copies, we can distribute them. It's a copyrightist nightmare as a technology. And so we have the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and other kinds of protections aimed at stopping, preventing certain forms of distribution. Here's another kind of countervailing practice. The mob can have a voice too, and as we see in this graphic that represents the incident in Charleston, South Carolina in 1835, where citizens attacked the U.S. Post Office in order to interrupt the flow of abolitionist literature from the North into the South. And this kind of mob activity happened in numerous places in the South, pre-Civil War. The abolitionist literature was illegal. It was still sneaking through the U.S. Post Service, and there were mob actions to prevent it. We don't have to go very far in our history to see another comparable sort of occlusion of the right to speak in the form of Gamergate that happened this past year. Zoe Quinn and Anita Sarkeesian are feminist critics of video games. Zoe Quinn's a designer. And the Gamergate controversy was basically an attack by male gamers against both of them, including threats of death and rape against both of these women and others. And that prevented Sarkeesian from giving a talk that she was scheduled to give at Utah State University. So she did not have access to the podium. She was blocked because of her critique of video games. So the mob has a force, and that's one of the issues. I think one of the ethical issues on the Internet, I deal with this in my ethics, digital media ethics course, is the way that the mob can step in and silence people very easily to do on the Internet. It's a powerful form of control of voices and messages that you don't want to hear on both sides of the political spectrum. In 1841, when Frederick Douglass started speaking to abolitionist groups in New England, his speech was constrained in a number of ways. At first, he was only allowed to tell the facts about his slave experiences. White abolitionist sponsors told him to just tell about the slave stories, and we'll do the interpretation part. And Frederick Douglass argued successfully for the right eventually to express his own philosophy, to interpret his own experience, and in a sense to control his own speaking content as well as his manner of dress, presentation, voice, rhythm, and gestures, and so on. So he was assigned a very limited speaking role. Stand up over here on the side, we'll tell the people what it means. He moved to the center. So even in liberal abolitionist New England, he had to argue for that right to be heard in that way. In 1843, when he was on a speaking tour in Vermont and moving across upstate New York, he had limited speaking venues. He says, even Syracuse would not at that time furnish us with church, market, house, or hall in which to hold our meetings. It would be easy to silence anti-slavery agitation by refusing its agents the use of halls and churches could affect that result. So he would speak in parks or in front of private homes or in front of the post office or on street corners until eventually he gained the right to speak in churches and public halls. And as he toured through upstate New York, in each and every town, he had to re-argue this position, finding a place to speak, a podium, a platform, a hall, a church, a park. Now, as he moved west and south on his tour, as he moved from the Great Lakes watershed into the Mississippi watershed, he encountered more difficulties. In Richmond, Indiana, he was physically prevented from speaking. He found it impossible to obtain a building, so he and his colleagues erected a platform in the woods where quite a large audience assembled. But his speaking was interrupted by a mob that, as he says, tore down the platform on which we stood and attacked the speakers, including Douglass. He was beaten unconscious and left with a broken hand, which never recovered its full strength and dexterity. So again, the mob has an influence on this process as well. Ida B. Wells was a journalist and leading advocate in the anti-lynching campaign of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In 1892, she wrote an editorial against lynching in her hometown newspaper in Memphis, Tennessee. The result was that the white community in Memphis destroyed her press and attempted to kill her partner. And let it be known that if Wells ever set foot in the state of Tennessee again, she would be killed. And at that point, Wells had to become an exile. She continued to write and speak as an advocate against lynching, but she could not do so in Tennessee. So cut off from her home podium, she had to construct a new platform, a new venue for her work. So she went to Chicago, and she also became a new kind of rhetorician. She was always well known for her journalistic skills in the technical textual sense, but she became more of what we might call a civic or community leader. She started clubs and civic organizations. She organized boycotts. She initiated lawsuits, all of which is rhetorical action, which, as Jackie Royster rightly points out, is also a form of public rhetoric. Now a different kind of story. A rhetorical act by someone who is not at all a famous writer or speaker, someone who delivered in a nonverbal way, like the Herm Choppers. At age 29, Edward Snowden was a computer specialist working as a contractor for the National Security Administration. In May and June 2013, he leaked classified documents to the media indicating that the United States was involved in illegal and unauthorized surveillance of citizens' communication. Phone and internet records on a huge scale that was, and still is, undoubtedly unconstitutional. The U.S. government filed a criminal complaint against Snowden, charging him with violating the 1917 Espionage Act for unauthorized release of national defense information. He is currently in exile in Russia, where he has a 3-year residency permit. Question: does his story belong in this set of delivery tales or not? What I'm suggesting here is, obviously, that the topos of access is incredibly important to the canon of delivery and incredibly important to rhetoric, especially those rhetors who are challenging powerful and prevailing interests, the people who are rocking the boat and threatening the status quo. It is the rhetorical strategy that attempts to change the rules that gets you on the podium in the first place, which, if you look at the rhetorical tracks that I referred to earlier, they don't talk about that issue. It's just not an issue. So what I want to do now is turn more toward the concept of system as a rhetorical category in order to see, and this is my claim, I guess, today, is that system is an important and useful category for rhetoric from a number of standpoints, but particularly for delivery and access. Now, one thing I would say about this particular slide is that when people have talked about access, they have typically talked about the top two bullet points, I think. Technology, production, what are the materials for production of discourse? Do you have access to those materials? Do you know how to use them? Or distribution, printing press, copying machines, assembly halls, and so on. The term access hasn't tended to cover so much the bottom three, but I think it should. The question of literacy education, who has access to it, who doesn't have access to it, what form does it take? In the 19th century, and Rhea and I were talking about this last night, a number of educational systems prevented people from speaking in their native language. Native Americans in this country, for instance, the Irish in their country were not allowed to speak, were not allowed to learn or speak in Irish. So in a sense, it's an access issue based on language education and literacy education. And then what I'm looking at today, system, legal codes and regulations that promote or prohibit, enable or restrict the flow, the creation and the flow of information. So I think all of that belongs under access. All right. The great contribution of the new rhetoric of the 1950s and 1960s, I think, was to rescue rhetoric from current traditionalism and from new criticism. It challenged the authority of those sacred discourse unities, text and author. In a sense, to me, it brought context and audience back to text. It told us we couldn't look at the text alone as an isolated object. We had to look at context in a rich way. And the scholars I would mention in this regard who did this kind of work, Lloyd Bitzer's article in 1968 from Philosophy and Rhetoric, which is on the handout, the rhetorical situation was critical. And then in the field of composition, Jim Kenevy and Janice Lauer. I did my dissertation on Jim Kenevy. I was talking about that earlier, James Kenevy's theory of discourse. And Janice Lauer, who is my mentor at the University of Detroit and who I worked with at Purdue University. And I see some of what they did was it involved taking the insights of the new rhetoric and bringing them into the composition classroom and saying that composition wasn't just about arrangement and style, it was also about invention and audience and context and social situation and so on. So I'd call that moment in the field a frame shift. And I think we're seeing a comparable frame shift happening now. And what I'm seeing is a shift toward a more fluid circulation model. And I'm starting to hear the word circulation studies pop up here and there. Or an ecological model that kind of counters the more static situation model that the new critics put forward. And two scholars I mentioned there on the reading list are Jenny Rice Edbauer and Catherine Chappett have directly critiqued the situation model, which Edbauer says masks the fluidity of rhetoric. So we have to put movement and timing, kairos, back into rhetoric in a sense. And I think especially in the digital realm where the velocity of the conversation is much more rapid than in speech or print situations. And again, here is where I think the concept of system can be helpful. All right, for me, the word system harkens back to the 1960s. The counterculturalists of the 1960s would say that system was the dominant power, represented the dominant cultural values. You were against the system, the mainstream, the military-industrial complex, the establishment, big brother, the man, the boss. That was all the system. It was a very helpfully ambiguous phrase. We weren't sure what the system was, but by God, we were against it. And it was clearly a bad thing. Now, I don't see the system as either necessarily bad or as a single monolithic thing. And here's where we start to get into the metaphor discussion. Systems, ecologies, networks, assemblages. What is that? What are those things and how do they interconnect? There's something there that is not necessarily bad, is simply there holding things aloft, but in constant need of oversight, critique, and revision. So I think if I look at my career, I think of myself as having worked in the university system, right? Which is really, you know, six different universities. But there is a system there, a way of doing things that holds the place together and moves people from point to point to point. There are reasons why we're moving from this room to this room to this room, and we do this, we do that. There's economic reasons, there's social reasons, there's personal reasons. That's the system. And the university system I have always had immensely deep respect for, and I'm glad I've been a part of it. At the same time, I'm always trying to fix the thing, you know, and make it better, you know. So, and also I'm keenly aware of its deep prejudices and flaws, but, you know, it's the system that I'm part of, and so, you know, I see my job as sort of like cardiology, you know, unclogging the arteries of the system or something like that. Maybe that's a bad metaphor. I shouldn't go too far with that one. But I see a number of different people making a case, but using various metaphors to talk about the thing, the system. And I don't want to suggest that these terms are all the same. They're not. But I think they're all attempting to grasp at something important to rhetoric that we haven't fully articulated or sufficiently attended to in our rhetoric theory. So I applaud the effort and enthusiastically engage the discussion. So I want to look at just three versions of this very quickly. Jane Bennett would say that we live within assemblages. She's borrowing from Deleuze and Guattari here, that are not simply human communities, but that also include objects and things working as actants. These assemblages exert an effect beyond what any individual human agent intends or anticipates, or beyond what the collective intends or anticipates. These are not coherent or communal, but they're messy, incongruous, conflicted, unpredictable, and unintentional operations. Things move within these assemblages, often without any single conscious or guiding intent. So according to Bennett, humans are not in full control of the assemblages in which they live and reside, though they affect them. They can interact with them, live in them, change them. But the assemblages exert their own political force, she would call it, or rhetorical force, I would say. And the system or the assemblage is also in a dynamic state of becoming. Within it, things circulate and take shape, new things are produced, and bad things can happen or good things can happen. The bad thing that Bennett talks about, she says, she talks about her example of the North American power grid blackout in August 2003. The entire grid blacked out in the Great Lakes part of the United States. And that was, she said, in short, the grid can speak. The grid had made a decision, performed an action that was not understood or known or certainly not intended by any member and certainly not by any human agency. Electricity had its own mind, as it worked. John Law talks about the role of objects as actants in actor network theory, which I think is a really important theory for understanding the role of technology. So think back here to my earlier slide about instrumentalism versus substantivism. The mistake is to see the technology as an abstracted tool versus as a rhetorical actant in a dynamic network. And he talks, the example he pulls forward is the Portuguese sailing vessel of the 1500s, the carack. To see the boat as the technology is to miss the revolution. Or another example he uses, the Zimbabwe bush pump. To see the technology as the bush pump is to miss how the technology works in its context of use in a particular community and village. And that is the instrumentalist fallacy, separating the technology as object from its full ecological and systemic context. So see the boat as an object in an entire system of relations. On a number of different levels, and notice there are a number of different levels of system here. For instance, the vessel itself has an immense amount of technology in it. A network of hulls, spars, sails, ropes, guns, food stores, sleeping quarters, not to mention human crew. On the other hand, if you turn up the magnification in a different direction, you have to look at the navigational system, the science which guides the ship on its travels. Its slate for calculations, its charts, its navigation system, its stars. Recruited to the system and playing their role is another aspect of the network. Then again, turn down the magnification and think about the Portuguese imperial system, ports, entrepots, its vessels, its military dispositions, its markets, its merchants, its principles as a network, and the economic models that move things through that system. You know, there's a number of different technology layers, all of which are contributing to this array of relations. That's his description of the system. So this is my, sort of my warning to object-oriented ontology. So beware the intense focus on objects, which, without also attending to the systems of relations which both constitute the objects and provide the range of possibility and impossibility for them. Yeah, sure, there are objects in these systems, but the objects, the boat is not a boat until you've got the whole system there, which Law says. Michel Foucault reminds us to beware of all unities of discourse. Systems are not just about objects, but they're also practices, design spaces, architectures, regulations, laws, prohibitions and exclusions about, as Foucault puts it, what can and cannot be said. Institutions, economic pressures and processes, social relations, what he calls a discursive system. And then there are also mobs. You don't like the way the discursive system is going, they'll disrupt it. In The Archaeology of Knowledge and the Discourse on Language, Foucault talks of the discursive formation, which he calls the regulatory system that creates the distinction between truth and falsehood, sanity and insanity, what is acceptable versus what is not. And in Foucault, this is definitely not a stable thing. It might stay stable for some historical time and culture, but then it abruptly jerks and shifts and unexpectedly moves in a new direction, a new paradigm. And in his work, he tracks several of these different kinds of shifts. Why did the criminal justice system in France just dramatically shift, almost overnight, it seemed, from one way of dealing with the felon's body to another method, incarceration? How did that happen and why? How did the system of relations shift? In every society, the production of discourse is at once controlled, selected, organized, and redistributed according to a certain number of procedures whose role is to avert its powers and its dangers, or to cope with chance events, to evade its ponderous, awesome materiality. So, what I'm talking about here, and here's where the connection to access comes in, I think, are both systems of production, systems of circulation, practices, customs, just what people do. And the two in yellow that I'm particularly interested in right now and looking at are, you know, regulation I've long been looking at, mostly in the form of intellectual property. And I'm looking more and more at economy as a kind of topic of rhetoric. Not economy in the capital sense, but economy in the Bourdieuian sense of value. Well, how does value play a part in the way that things circulate and move, the way that discourse happens? And these systems are, you know, enable us to do things. The university system enables us to do things that are good to do. It also restricts what we can do. There are impedances in the system. And so we're constantly in the process of arterial cleansing, trying to make the system do its job or do something different. All of which brings us to the pasture. The commons, the public domain. The commons is that part of the systems, plural, we live in, which is shared with others cooperatively. It is not so much a separate system, but it's an important space that intersects and connects with other more proprietary spaces. It's our podium. It's our place to speak to the world. Larry Lessig has been a strong advocate of the creative commons, the internet commons, by which he means a resource that is free, not necessarily zero cost. The commons always cost something to maintain. But if there is a cost, it is neutrally imposed or equally imposed cost. Central Park is a commons, an extraordinary resource of peacefulness in the center of a city that is anything but an escape and refuge that anyone can take and use without the permission of anyone else. The public streets are a commons on no one's schedule but your own. You enter the public streets and you go in any direction you wish. The commons have to be paid for? Absolutely. The commons have rules and regulations? Absolutely. You can't do anything you want in the commons. But they are neutrally, if there's a cost, it is neutrally imposed. It is also fairly imposed. The idea of a commons is it should be accessible to everybody, more or less. That doesn't mean it's always free, but usually low cost. That's the idea. National parks, a good example of that. What we produce as writers is both enabled and constrained by intellectual property law and particularly by the architecture of the public domain. And whenever we write in the United States, and you should teach this to your students and never forget it yourself, you are writing under the provisions of the U.S. Copyright Act. We write within a property regime that regulates, license, and authorizes our use of words, sounds, and images. Whether we put the license on it or not, we're working within that regime. So in other words, access to the bar, the pulpit, and the assembly cannot be assumed. There are plenty of recent legislative attacks on the public commons, ranging from things like the anti-net neutrality regulations, SOPA, Stop Online Piracy Act, PIPA, the Protect IP Act, copyright extension legislation, that sort of thing. All of those activities might seem remote to the concerns of rhetoric, but at its root, this legislation involves a fundamental question of rhetoric. Who has the right to speak and under what conditions? How and where will you and your students be able to speak? And Larry Lessig came to the Four C's, in, I think it was 2005, and gave a wonderful talk about remix and the right to write. He said to the Four C's people, the right to write is under attack right now, and it's being constrained by a whole series of legislative activities aimed at shutting down commons and the internet commons in general. So I guess I'm suggesting that we are all hermocopidae in the sense that we have to struggle to secure and maintain our right to speak, right, deliver that message in the public forum. And so access, I see, has always been a part of the rhetoric and is part of the art of rhetoric. I'm seeing that more and more. But I'm also seeing we have not always taught it. So I'll end with this poem from, it's an anonymous English poem that's quoted by James Boyle in his work. The law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, but leaves the greater villain loose, who steals the common from off the goose. Thank you.
We have time for Q's and A's? I mean, you all have Q's.
I have Q's.
What did you give the column?
You mentioned use value and exchange value. Are those related to circulation versus distribution in your mind? And if so, how? Are they, does one correspond to the other?
Well, the distinction I make is distribution is sort of what I as rhetor intend starting out. And what I and then circulation is what can happen to the thing. And I, as I, when I, you know, in the internet age, what I have to do, if I'm going to be an effective writer, is write for circulation. I want my message to go viral. And so I have to put into it, I have to design it and put into it the conditions that are going to insist that to happen. And that's the big question now with spreadable media. How do we get that to happen? Every business on the planet wants to know how to go viral. It seems to me that that distinction is important. So when you hear the question, I want to start with that, making that. And then the question is, what am I doing it for? What's the immediate value? What's the long-term value? What's going to move that thing through the system? It's going to be valuable to somebody out there for some purpose. And it doesn't have to be commercial purpose. So I don't. I want to disconnect it from the commercial, although that's certainly part of it. But there's also interest value. There's political value. There's entertainment value. There's engagement value. People just want to be engaged. And those are all part of the exchange value and the give and take and gift in what we call a gift-sharing economy. And a perfect example of gift-sharing economy, I think, is... most research scholarship at the university lives in a gift-sharing economy. Sure, there's money that moves around, but a lot of it is based on reciprocity, you know, listserv activity. That's entirely reciprocity, I would say, mostly. Did I get at your question?
It does. I'm wondering if... So what you're talking about, that gift economy, does that correspond with use value or exchange value in your mind? Because one of them has to do with how commodities stack up against other commodities, right? Is that right?
I don't know, but I would say it has to do with both.
Okay.
I think with scholarship, there's use value, but there's also exchange value. I'm thinking of a list, you know, typical scholar of this sort of group. Is that, that's what I would say.
Okay.
I was curious about the NSA case you were talking about. Mm-hmm. She asked if it was a case of delivery. And I was thinking about it for a little while, and I was wondering, is there any way that you could potentially deliver that information that wouldn't have resulted within the dry press page? Or is that already just, he was completely restricted from delivering it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. That, you know, I gave you a very brief summary, but there's an entire deep backstory to this about his. He's talked about this in interviews and some writing. So he's becoming a celebrity, and now he is writing and speaking, giving interviews, and talking about why he did it the way he did it, and it was a very thoughtful, strategic decision, I would say. He didn't think he could whistleblow from inside. He thought he would be locked up and disappear. And he had to think about how he was going to do it and when he was going to do it. And so there's the whole story of sort of the micro decisions that he had to make along the way that led up to the big decision to release information. There was also information he did not release. You know, he made a decision, I'm going to release this stuff but not this other stuff because this other stuff would be directly, immediately harmful. But releasing this material would show the problem without causing pain. So it was a very... thoughtful, I think, ethical decision, whether you agree with it or not. It wasn't just done randomly. There was thought to it. Do you think it's rhetoric?
Yeah,
okay.
I found it fascinating they could actually try him on espionage. Releasing something that they were doing was unconstitutional. It was the whole legal jargon that was going on.
Well, the question now is what's going to happen on his three-year residency? Is that, where is he going to go? Because the U.S. has been very, you know, scarily insistent on getting him back.
So I think I have three questions for you. Is that okay?
You can.
So one, can I
say no to her?
So I do one at a time because I'm not
sure.
Sure,
okay. Sure, sure.
So one term. This is off topic. Okay, in a way. I mean, it's related to delivery, but one term that a lot of people use these days when they're talking about delivery is velocity, and you don't. So that interests me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think velocity is part of this, but not vital to, you know, not really important, so I just don't talk about it.
Okay, and but, you don't know why you don't think it's important?
Well, but here, I'm beginning to see it as more important than I used to.
Okay.
because the speed of the thing is also changing the culture and rhetoric of the thing.
Okay.
And if I go back and look at the history of the telegraph, it wasn't just that the message got across from New York to San Francisco instantly as opposed to 3 weeks. That didn't just make things faster, it actually changed the identity culture of what the United States was. It made a social and cultural difference. So coming back to the internet, how does the speed change the rhetoric of the thing? And certainly in terms of journalists, I think, are all over this now about how the speed of reporting has changed what they do, what's defined as news and not news. And there's all kinds of ethical issues surrounding that. So I'm beginning to see it as more important.
Okay. But you wouldn't... So we've spent some time looking at your heuristic, right? Mm-hmm. So access, interaction economics, circulation distribution, and so on. You wouldn't add velocity to the heuristic?
Sure. You can add it.
No. I didn't say, could I add it? You answered that question. I answered the question. I see the question whether you would add it to the jurisdiction.
I'd put it in there, sure.
Would you?
Yeah, I'd put it in there under circulation.
Okay, under circulation. So not one of the five dimensions.
Okay, my theory of heuristics is they're not set. They should never be set in stone. It's a set of categories that's useful. Add to it, subtract to it, move it, reshape it, you know, it doesn't matter. But as long as you have the important things down there. So... But I can see moving velocity to a higher place than I have assigned it previously. Absolutely. That was just one question?
It was.
Chris has a follow-up.
Chris has.
Oh, okay. Well.
I noticed in answering that question that you switch from velocity to speed. And if I remember correctly, those of you whose experience with physics is more recent than mine, isn't velocity speed plus direction? And what happens then if you think about circulation as velocity in terms of speed plus direction?
Speed plus direction, yeah.
Anything, or is that just a ratchet question?
I think that's right. I think that velocity is different than speed, but I'd have to work really hard to figure out exactly why. I will say that, I mean, on my own prelim exam, one of the questions was about, in fact, it was a very interesting question. It was 19th century Victorian literature. And if you'd asked me about the role of speed in 19th century novels in particular, I could have written all day long. It wasn't about speed, it was about philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you I chose not to answer that question. So this has been with me for some time. And philosophy is really not quite speed.
You're
I was
right, going
to
yeah.
be pleasant, but she wanted to be pleasant. So.
Well, actually, I could be wrong. It could be that speed is philosophy plus direction.
Well, it still would be speed plus. The moment you say plus, then it's different.
Whenever humanists get into physics, it's always a bad idea.
All right, I'll ask you one other question. I'll delete it. I'll save some for the pop-up. Why should you eat and enjoy your meal when I can cover you with questions? So I thought the slide that had the terms that are sort of in dialogue with each other was really, really interesting. So you had, let's see if I can pull it up. Assemblage, networks, ecologies, That's pretty interesting. Can you talk a little bit? There were two questions embedded in the one. So one is, those terms are all in dialogue with each other, but at the same time, aren't they really doing different kinds of intellectual work? I mean, network and ecology, for example, there's some relationship there, but it's really not quite the same thing. That's question one, the one question. And question two is, I loved the law slide with the unit of analysis or the unit of scale as being a differentiating feature across the concept of network. But doesn't that occlude as much as it reveals? Okay, those are my two.
Yes, it does. Okay. This is my Chris Fleckenstein slide. I wanted to put this in front of Chris to see that's a genuine question. What metaphor of this is, you know, because they're not, I don't think they're the same, but I think they are sort of talking about what comparable related things, something systemic. Networks, assemblages, ecologies, systems, those, you know, how do those work as different things? And that's kind of where I am. I haven't answered that question for myself. And I know you're an advocate of ecologies, but maybe you don't mean what I'm talking about here.
I've used ecologies. I like systems theory. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the question I have is about how you're using the system. Mm-hmm. And am I?
No, go ahead.
I'm teaching an upper division undergraduate course this semester, and we're looking at new materialisms and one of the things that we read in this book is fiber matter. She uses complex systems theory, and she borrows from, as you know, from Deleuze and Guattari to talk about assemblages within the context of complex systems, which means then that system never becomes the system. The system never becomes an entity because the system is always an event. It's always in a process. It's always changing. So I wondered, as you were working through your understanding of the system, if that is also how you understand the system. Because that's very different, I think, from thinking about it as a university system. But not so different from thinking about circulation.
So I'm pulling more from Foucault's sense of discursive system or discursive formation, which is more like institution, but not society. Society is too fixed, and it is definitely a more discursive construct. He's talking about an assemblage of things that is held together. The glue that holds it together is discourse of various kinds, including practice. And practice is critically important, but also architecture and other symbolic actions. So that's where I'm getting it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm wondering where it, you know, it intersects with actor network theory, where it intersects with the new materialism, which I'm very sympathetic to the new materialism, but I'm, when you go to object-oriented ontology, I get off the bus. That's a mistake to me. That's not new materialism, right?
No.
Okay.
In fact, I would say Bennett's pushing back.
Okay.
Definitely against that.
Okay.
If anything, I think, well, that's getting off the subject, but I agree with you there.
But objects are actants. I am totally on board with that. I think that is the way, that's a useful way to think about it. Martha, did you?
Okay. When Dr. Fleckenstein was saying how Jane Bennett is talking about the system as an action or as a multiple, it's always happening, right? Something that's always happening.
It's an event.
So it's not the system, it's things that are happening all the time. So I'm thinking about your you mentioned the Sarkeesian and the business with Gamergate, and just a few weeks ago, I'm sure you're aware, Wikipedia's Supreme Court, they call it, kicked a bunch of feminists off of Wikipedia. They can no longer edit not just about Gamergate, but anything that has anything to do with gender or feminism or sexuality. So, so I'm thinking about, like, they no longer have access to those articles on Wikipedia, but if the system is an event, or systems are events, And we think of the internet as some sort of physical space or some sort of, you know, material space, then they still have other access. So, you know, obviously they're out there on Twitter. Everybody knows that this is a habit, right? They're making that known on Twitter or on Facebook or on all kinds of other places, their blogs and blogs and things like that. So, where am I going with this? I'm thinking when Dr. Yancey introduced you, she said that your website doesn't say anything about audience. So I guess the question has to do with, if you don't have access to a particular site, but now you have access to other sites within the system, then are we just talking about the economy of audience and, you know, where and how we get more attention? These women are not giving up. The system is not giving up. They're getting their word out.
But they have to go to some other place to do it.
That's right.
And here's the added advantage. Getting kicked off Wikipedia may help them in a different
exactly.
way that's actually better. And this is,
yeah.
I'm thinking of the Ida Wells example now,
yeah.
because, okay, she was restricted in Tennessee. She moved to Chicago. She can do a lot more, although she's not in the locus of where the problem is. So there's a disadvantage and advantage, I think, to that move. But that's her answer to the problem, to the prohibition. I can't do this. I'm going to go do this other thing and do it here. And then doing it that way is then going to have an effect, perhaps, and change what else happens. You know, I mean, if I think of Selma, that was an event that was taken to the locus of the problem at that time, knowing what would happen and did happen. And there was a reason for that in terms of the timing of the of that rhetorical action, in terms of the time and place and culture. You know, and it was a horrible event, but it actually led to legislative change. So what do we make of that rhetorically?
Another question?
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of what you are?
I'm researching a group called the Gorilla Girls,
mm-hmm.
and they're an anonymous art activist group. They wear gorilla masks to speak publicly, to display their artwork, and to identify themselves to be to jeopardize their art careers,
mm-hmm.
because they're artists and kind of they're non-activists, they're not
mm-hmm.
gorilla-like.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm interested in what you think about that sort of action.
That, the way you've described it, it sounds great to me. There's a purpose to the anonymity that makes sense in terms of what they're trying to affect and do. It's not about the individual; it's about the art. We want to, you know, shift the focus. When you first said anonymity, I thought, you know, of the offensive tirades that people do behind the mask of anonymity, which I think is horrible. It's unethical. Do I think it should be illegal? No. But, you know, I think it's bad rhetoric, and I think it's hurtful rhetoric that should be opposed on every front. But, you know, to me, what you're talking about is something very different. Anonymity for a positive, productive purpose. Sure, absolutely. And that's a Supreme Court issue. Can we have can freedom of speech be anonymous? And the answer has been yes, it can. And in the U.S. So that's, you know, and I am for that. So that doesn't relieve people of the obligation, though, to speak and write responsibly, even when anonymously, like on course evaluations.
Yeah. Last question,
Chris. I was going to ask. You talked about the mob, and then talked about that kind of manifesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what you thought about anonymity and the potential for, like, mob.
Well, the mob is always operating in anonymity. So, I mean, always, mostly they are. Yeah, mostly they are. And you know, the New York Times brought up the history of lynching article too. And you know, it was the collective mob, the nameless. They weren't faceless because the faces were were actually published, but there was never a name given to the mob, and so that was, in a sense, how they sort of hid themselves. I'm just one of the group, the collective, the city, the community. So I think that's the worst kind of behavior. But it's out there. It works. It's constantly in the history of rhetoric. What do you do about it? It's occluding our delivery, our circulation.
On that note, would you please join me in thanking you?